On our last program, we discussed how the colonists had resorted to the use of their own paper money, which some colonists referred to as scrip. They used their scrip because the English would not supply them with enough specie to carry on trade in their rapidly expanding economy. Benjamin Franklin stated this fact quite cogently when he said, "They had to use English money. This meant that the colonies had to discard their own scrip and mortgage themselves to the Bank of England in order to get money." When the transfer of the scrip for borrowed money was made, the colonists got only half as many units in payment in borrowed money as they gave up in scrip. The circulating medium was reduced by 50%. 1 year from the date of the money transfer, the streets of the colonies were filled with the unemployed. The colonies would gladly have borne the little tax on tea and other matters had it not been that England took away from the colonies their money, which created unemployment and dissatisfaction. Although Benjamin Franklin didn't say it, this was the first time our country's money system was based on debt. The inability of the colonists to get power to issue their own money and take it away of the hands of King George III and the international bankers was the prime reason for the Revolutionary War. The continental currency and the revolution were inseparable. Our Declaration of Independence was written in 1776. This was the same year Adam Smith wrote The Wealth of Nations. He said, "The stability of the Bank of England is equal to that of the British government. It acts as a great engine of the state." I mention Adam Smith here only because he lived and wrote during the same era our country was suffering from its initial birth pangs. Adam Smith will be discussed later when we discuss the consequences of the present monetary system. Suffice it to say that even though he is considered the father of modern economics, and even though he is considered the creator of political economics, and even though British prime ministers as far back as William Pitt and as recently as Margaret Thatcher carried the wealth of nations with them at all times, it is this narrator's opinion that Adam Smith's ideas have been a detriment to societies since his conception of economics became popular. We had mentioned on the last program how the English had used counterfeiting as one weapon, a very powerful weapon, in fighting the war with the colonies. The English ship HMS Phoenix, a ship of 44 guns, was lying in the New York Harbor and was turning out counterfeits of the $30 bill. Then, when General Howe took New York in 1776, New York became the center for counterfeiting. The English were trying to win the war by debauching the colonies' money. But, according to General Clinton, the English general, in his report to Lord Germain on the English army's counterfeiting of the colonials' paper money, he said that the experiments suggested by your lordships have been tried. No assistance that could be drawn from the power of gold or the arts of counterfeiting have been left untried, but still the continental currency has not failed. Beginning in 1777, continental currency depreciated precipitously, so Congress resorted to general price controls, which enjoyed the same level of success such measures always do, little or none. Finally, in March 1780, with the Continentals good for about 2.5 cents on the dollar, Congress gave up the pretense that notes were on par with coin. Congress stopped issuing paper money and issued an announcement declaring almost total default. But the darkest days of the Revolution probably came in June. The money was depreciating, Congress was being deluged with petitions for tax exemptions, and taxes were not forthcoming. In 1778 and 1779, the Treasury had received only $151,666 in gold and silver needed for foreign purchases. The Continental Congress found its treasury penniless and the government creditless. George Washington's army was threatening to mutiny at any time. So according to Thomas Paine, the only thing that was capable of reaching the case was private credit. He drew out $500 of his own money and sent it with a letter to a man in Philadelphia by the name of Blair McClenahan. McClenahan and Robert Morse each donated 200 pounds sterling in coin, and others donated another 1,360 pounds sterling in Continentals. A short time later, they decided to form the fund into a bank to be called the Pennsylvania Bank, with a subscription of 300,000 pounds sterling. Congress deposited 15,000 pounds sterling in bills of exchange and promised more. The bank began operation in July 1780 and invested in bounties for recruitment and food supplies for the army. In February 1781, Congress appointed Robert Morse as superintendent of finance. In May of the same year, he presented a plan to Congress to establish the Bank of North America. It passed by one vote. James Madison was vehemently opposed to it. The bank was to be capitalized with 1,000 shares of stock at $400 per share for a total of $400,000. The subscription of the Pennsylvania Bank was transferred to the Bank of North America, but only $70,000 had been paid in by October 1781. In the same month, a French frigate arrived with $470,000 in coins, and that was immediately deposited into the bank, and specie was again in circulation thanks to French monetary imports. This gave the United States ownership of 633 shares of stock in the Bank of North America. Shortly after the arrival of the $70,000 in coins from France, Cornwallis surrendered to George Washington. I guess you noticed that the United States was using the term dollar instead of pound sterling to define their money. The dollar, or thaler, did not originate with the Spaniards, as many people believe. The dollar is short for the Joaquin Thaler, or Joaquin Thal, a mining town in the Joaquin Valley of Bohemia, where the silver was first mined and coined in 1518. The term dollar was being used quite extensively during the Revolutionary War when denominating the Continentals. It is easy to condemn the Continental Congress's venture into hyperinflation, but difficult to see how Congress could have financed the revolution otherwise. At the time, many people did not see the episode as a failure at all. The liquidity was received favorably, at least at first, and the depreciation was seen as an informal tax for financing the war. And, of course, the war had been won. Which brings us into the Confederation era. Congress approved the Articles of Confederation in 1777, although they did not become effective until the 13th state, which was Maryland, ratified them in 1781. The Articles gave Congress the sole and exclusive right and power of regulating the alloy and value of coin struck by their own authority or by that of the respective states, and fixing the standards of weights and measures throughout the United States. Congress also received authority to emit bills on the credit of the United States, what we commonly call bills of credit. However, the Confederated Congress declined to exercise this power, but during the period the Articles were in effect, which was from March 1, 1781 to June 21, 1788, 10 of the states did, in fact, emit paper money. The experience in some states was good. South Carolina notes were not legal tender, yet they were well-backed and traded at a premium. Depreciation was mild in New York. In other states, such as North Carolina and most notoriously Rhode Island, inflation was severe. During this period, many people became concerned that state-level paper money emissions might trigger interstate trade wars. In 1786, Rhode Island issued paper money, at least partly, to relieve resident debtors pressed by out-of-state creditors. This money depreciated quickly. 2 years later, debtors could escape for as little as 10 cents on the dollar. To ensure that creditors accepted this currency, the legislature of Rhode Island passed a law declaring that anyone who refused to accept these bills could be fined without benefit of trial by jury. Debtors from other states owing money to Rhode Island creditors decided they could play the same game. When sued in Rhode Island courts, out-of-state debtors tendered Rhode Island paper money. This outraged the Rhode Island legislature, and they responded by ordering state judges to refuse to recognize any such tender from a debtor who was not a Rhode Island resident. Connecticut lawmakers thereupon provided that Rhode Islanders could not collect debts in Connecticut until its neighbor repealed the discriminatory statutes against non-residents. Such struggles between states later became fodder for the ratification debates. Extant comments by James Wilson and James Madison suggest that they believed the states were incompetent to handle the coinage power and that it should be lodged in the federal government. Assuming that delegates to the Constitutional Convention generally held this belief, one might ask why convention delegates enumerated a specific coinage power when, by common understanding, congressional authority over commerce would decide authority over measures and money as well. One possibility is that the delegates chose to include a specific coinage power because the congressional commerce power did not extend to some commerce. The Articles of Confederation included express powers over measures and money, but only because the Articles granted Congress no general power over commerce. Excluded was commerce that was neither foreign nor interstate, nor with Indian tribes, nor, quote, necessary and proper to regulate in pursuit of an enumerated power. Moreover, some activities benefiting from standard measurements, such as manufacturing and agriculture, were not commerce at all in the contemporaneous sense of the word. Including a separate power to coin money, regulate the value thereof, and a foreign coin, and fix the standard of weights and measures, enabled Congress to set measurement standards for all transactions within the United States. What the convention records have to say about paper money? It is possible and probable that most of the delegates at the federal convention were hostile to paper money. They were particularly hostile to state emissions of paper money, which accounts for their adopting an express ban on state bills of credit and tender laws. This does not, however, answer the question whether most of them intended to deprive the new federal government of the power to emit paper money. The convention first laid down a series of resolutions governing the content of the Constitution and then delegated the job of producing the first draft to a committee of detail. That committee consisted of 5 members. They included Nathaniel Gorham of Massachusetts, a merchant and former president of Congress, and 4 distinguished lawyers. On August 6, 1787, the committee presented its draft to the whole convention, which debated, supplemented, and amended it over the next few weeks. Those seeking the original meaning of the Constitution regarding paper money have focused much attention on the notes taken by James Madison on August 16, one of the days on which the delegates were picking apart the committee's draft. That draft included a congressional power to borrow money and emit bills of credit on the United States. The discussion on paper money began when Governor Morris moved to strike the language emit bills on the credit of the United States. His reason, apparently, was that this phrase would wave a red flag before some of the Constitution's potential supporters, and it would do so needlessly, for officials in the future government could find ways to borrow money without resorting to bills of credit. 11 delegates spoke in the debate on the Morris proposal. In the ensuing state-by-state vote, 9 states voted for the motion to remove the bill of credit language, and 2 states voted against it. This vote is sometimes cited as showing intent to deny the federal government the power to issue paper money. The records of the debate, however, demonstrate that the delegates who voted for the motion did so for various reasons. Some probably believed that they were banning paper currency. Others thought that the federal government would be able to issue such currency without the bill of credit language, but wanted to remove it to avoid offending potential ratifiers or encouraging Congress to emit paper money needlessly. Taking the discussion as a whole into consideration, one can infer no more than the following. Number 1. All those voting to retain the language explicitly authorizing federal bills of credit did so because they believed that the federal government should have the power to issue bills of credit, and deleting the language would delete the power. Number 2. Some voting to delete the language believed the federal government should not have the power to issue bills of credit, and deleting the language would delete that power. Number 3, others voting to delete the language believed that the federal government should have the power to issue bills of credit, but deleting the language would not delete that power. This final group voted to delete because they saw the committee's language as superfluous and imprudent. James Madison seems to have been in his own category. He thought that the federal government ought to have the power to issue paper money, but only if it were not legal tender, and deleting the language would achieve this result. Madison voted for the motion because he said he became satisfied that striking out the words would not disable the government from the use of public notes as far as they could be safe and proper, and would only cut off the pretext for a paper currency, and particularly for making the bills a tender either for public or private debts. Madison's interpretation is not fully accurate, however, because notes could and did serve as paper currency, and whether or not an item was a bill of credit was not the determination of its legal tender status. It is possible that the notes Madison was thinking of were Massachusetts Treasury notes, which were not legal tender, but which bore interest and were convertible on demand into specie. Those notes, however, certainly served as paper currency. In addition to the variation in delegates' views, another reason the import of the convention discussion is unclear is because we do not know how many delegates thought a ban on bills of credit would be equivalent to a ban on all paper money. As noted earlier, the phrase bill of credit was technically only one kind of paper money, a circulating instrument representing a government debt. The proceedings of the Committee of Detail are relevant to this issue. At the outset of the committee's work, Randolph was assigned to write an initial draft, which Rutledge then revised. With Rutledge's additions italicized and anonymous deletions struck through the coinage power, it looks like this. To the exclusive right of coining money, no state to be permitted in future to emit paper bills of credit without the approval of the national legislature, nor to make anything but specie a tender in payment of debts. Thus, Randolph initially provided for a congressional power to regulate coining, but Rutledge changed this to coining money and added the words paper prohibit. Rutledge also added the conditional ban on state paper bills of credit. The difference in the phrases paper prohibit and bills of credit suggest that the committee might not have considered the two to be synonymous. Certainly, the committee's coupling of the proposed bill of credit power with the borrowing power suggests that it understood the Specialized Debt Representation aspect of bills of credit as opposed to other forms of paper currency. Moreover, Rutledge's placement of paper prohibit suggests that he thought of this phrase as a qualification on the coining power, which in turn suggests that one could coin paper. Interestingly, the committee decided to delete Rutledge's proposed prohibition of federal paper money. Even though the convention later dropped the committee's federal bill of credit language, it never restored Rutledge's proposed prohibition. Thus, to the argument that the convention's deletion of the bill of credit power implied a loss of that power, one can counter that deletion of the ban of federal paper money implied a removal of that ban. With all the discussion spent on paper bills of credit and legal tender paper money, the Continental Congress did not get around to coining any metal money until 1787. We get the following information regarding the first coins issued in the United States from a guidebook of United States Coins, 35th edition. The first coins issued by authority of the United States were the Fugio cents. Entries in the Journal of Congress, Saturday, April 21st, 1787, reads as follows: that the Board of Treasury be authorized to contract for 300 tons of copper coin of the federal standard, agreeable to the proposition of Mr. James Jarvis, that it is to be coined at the expense of the contractor. Then on Friday, July 6, 1787, there was resolved that the Board of Treasury direct the contractor for the copper coinage to stamp on one side of each piece the following device, namely, 13 circles linked together, a small circle in the middle with the words United States around it, and in the center the words We Are One. On the other side of the same piece, the following device, namely a dial with the hours expressed on the face of it, a meridian sun above on one side, which is the word Fugio. The meaning is time flies, and on the other, the year in figures, 1787. Below the dial, the words, mind your business. The legends have been credited to Benjamin Franklin by many, and the coin, as a consequence, has been referred to as the Franklin cent. These cents were coined in New Haven, Connecticut, and possibly elsewhere. Most of the copper used in this coinage came from military stores. It is believed to have been the copper bands which held together the powder kegs sent to us by the French. This brings us now to the Constitutional Convention. In 1786, a book entitled Essays on Money was published anonymously. The book attacked the idea of government paper money. It was discovered later that the book was written by the Calvinist clergyman John Witherspoon, who had come to this country from England to become president of Princeton University. He had previously been president of Edinburgh College. He was the only clergyman to sign the Declaration of Independence. Witherspoon's book and his influence probably did as much damage as any merchant in leaving the back door open for the money power to take over. The decision of who would hold the money power was contained in five words, which were to emit bills of credit. They were already in the Articles of Confederation, but those articles were going to be replaced by the Constitution, which the Federalists had been pushing for. These five words were the authority under which the continental currency and the various colonial monies came to be issued. The Federalists were mostly merchants who wanted a stronger government. The Anti-Federalists consisted mostly of landowning farmers, and they were basically happy with the Articles of Confederation. The Federalists won that round, though, and the Constitutional Convention met from May to December 1787. There had been almost no discussion of the coinage or money powers until August 16th. During that discussion, all attention to the new nation was focused on the Constitution's limitations against the individual states issuing money. The question was, who would issue the nation's money? Would it be the government or would it be the private bankers? According to Witherspoon's book, this power should not be held by the government because they would issue worthless paper money. Besides Witherspoon, there were two other delegates who didn't want the government to have the power of issuing money. They were Robert Morris and Alexander Hamilton. They wanted to take the money power from the nation like it had been done in England. With this power, the bankers would be allowed to do what they had blocked the government from doing, that is, to create paper money by issuing their own banknotes, pretending to back them with gold and silver. Absent from the meetings were Thomas Jefferson and Thomas Paine. Benjamin Franklin was in attendance, even though he was so advanced in age that another person had to deliver his closing address. The Federalists wanted the government to be comparable to the English government. The Anti-Federalists regarded a federal government as a foreign government and were convinced that anyone entrusted with power would invariably abuse that power. A compromise was made with the checks and balances put in place and Madison's Bill of Rights, which seemed to block authoritarian rule. But the Constitution left the back door open, which allowed a more insidious authoritarian rule to enter. It was more dangerous because it was not understood, and therefore less visible. It was more sinister because its center of power was outside the country. Even though authoritarianism had been kept outside the government both religiously and politically, it was allowed in monetarily. It was the only kind of aristocracy that could exist in our political system. Alexander Del Mar probably described the result of the Constitutional Convention best when he said, quote, "Never was a historical event followed by a more feeble sequel. A nation arises to claim for itself liberty and sovereignty. It gains both of these ends by an immense sacrifice of blood and treasure. Then, when victory is gained and secured, it hands the national credit, that is to say, national treasure, over to private individuals to do as they please with it. They had before them the historical examples where the main contention, from first to last, between the aristocratic and popular factions arose out of and centered in the monetary system. That is the greatest of all dispensers of equity or inequity. They had only to take care that the seed they planted was genuine and uncontaminated. Nature was certain to do the rest. Well, they planted, and now look at the fruit and see what they planted. They planted financial corporations. They planted private money. They planted financial exemptions from public burdens. In a word, they planted another revolution." Well, that's our program for today. I hope you'll join us next time for more Money Matters.